Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So beginning the afternoon with a Dhamma reflection and doing a formal request, as I mentioned this morning, it's a suitable way to relate to the Dhamma, to the teachings, this aspect of having a certain quality of respect or reverence. Of course, it's not something that can be mandated or even kind of conjured up out of thin air, but how we relate to the Dhamma and the teachings has a certain conditioning quality on the effect that it has in the heart. The formal request for the teachings is just a phrase out of the suttas, out of the scriptures, and it's a recollection of when after the Buddha's enlightenment, and the Buddha had the thought in his mind, well, what's the point of teaching? This is way too difficult. And then, as the suttas recount, that the Brahma Sahampati, Brahma God, recognized that thought in the Buddha and then came to the Buddha and encouraged him with that sense that there are beings with little dust in their eyes. Without hearing the Dhamma, they'll be lost. And so that's what the request is, is a repetition of Brahma's request to the Buddha. And it's a beautiful recollection, and one that helps one to reflect on the timeless nature of the teachings, also the timeless nature of our own delusion and obstructions as well. I think people had the same problems in the time of the Buddha as we do, so it's not a strange thing. And then after the request has been chanted, then when I or any other teacher gives the teachings, then they do the Namo Tassa, which is paying homage to the Buddha, homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. This is actually a kind of a shorthand for the particular qualities of the Buddha. And when the Buddha is described as being of perfectly enlightened, it's a balance of three particular qualities: wisdom, compassion, and purity. And the word that is used for blessed is a recollection of the quality of compassion, in that the Buddha is bringing blessings to the world out of compassion. That's the word Bhagava. The Bhagava is the blessed one. Arahato is a kind of shorthand for purity, and the usual translation is one who is far from defilement, so that having been able to truly uproot the obstructions and things that obscure the mind. Samma Sambuddhassa is the recollection of the Buddha's wisdom, in that it's one who is realized awakening by himself. Samma Sambuddhassa is a perfect awakening. So that it's kind of a shorthand for these particular qualities, but they're the same qualities that we all need to bring to our life, bring to our practice. And they need to be in balance. We need to be constantly tuning in to how to balance these qualities of wisdom, of discernment, of being able to apply our intellect and rational mind skillfully. It needs to be balanced with aspects of loving kindness and compassion. It needs to be balanced with the aspects of purity. And of course, they all have the same. Say, purity needs to be balanced with wisdom and compassion. Compassion needs to be balanced with wisdom and purity. These are when these qualities are in balance, then there is an ability to express a full awakening. And to the extent that we bring these to mind, then we're able to really progress on the path of practice. And of course, when we recollect this, this is what the teachings are pointing to, on that recollection, and it's also that, say, when we do the Namo Tassa, then also finish with Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. It's an offering of respect and homage to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And particularly for one who is teaching, I mean, it applies to everybody, but particularly for one who is teaching, then it's important that it isn't about, it's not a personal thing. It's not one should be getting out of the way as much as possible. And you know, on a certain level, similarly, when we listen to Dhamma, we should be getting out of the way as well. And that one places the refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha foremost, as opposed to our own preferences and our habits and our conditioning. As we begin this retreat, we have the opportunity to dedicate a fairly good amount of time over these next 10 days to formal meditation, it's a great opportunity. As we sit in sitting meditation, I tend to emphasize mindfulness of breathing, mainly because that's what my own preference over decades of practice. And so that when I give instruction, I'll usually use the mindfulness of breathing as the foundation. But it's, the methodologies or the ways that one applies the mind are just as relevant to any other particular meditation object, whether it's using a mantra, which is very common in Thailand, using, say, like Buddho, and really focusing on that as a meditation object, or loving kindness meditation, or recollection of the body. These are all the particular techniques maybe a bit different, but the principles should apply fairly easily. In meditation, was to take one's posture and pay attention to the posture as one's sitting. It's important that we are sitting upright, and the breathing is fairly easy. One's not, because sometimes if we slump, then the breath becomes a bit constricted, so that it's not as smooth, and then also it tends to be sort of once energy falls, and then it's easy to for drowsiness to set in. But it also should be balanced in the sense that if one's holding oneself bolt upright and creating tension, then that also that tends to wear oneself out, wear oneself down, and one will tend to get restless or agitated in the practice. So there's finding a nice balance of an upright posture, and it's actually, I think it's easier to hold a balanced posture than it is to, if one's leaning to the left, leaning to the right, or leaning forwards. It's actually the body's actually meant to kind of be in balance, and be sitting. That upright posture is nice, is a nice balance. And as we sit in that upright posture, keeping the eyes downcast, or cast about maybe a 3 feet in front of one, so that there's the head is tilted forward slightly, but it's actually natural to the vertebrae, so that there's an ease there. When we root our awareness in the body, we've got a good foundation for sustaining that awareness. The body is always a good anchor for awareness. There's a simple phrase that I use, I heard and I use all the time, and that's it. The body is always in the present moment. So that is a great reminder. The mind, the moods can be all over the place, but as soon as you return awareness to the body, you're back in the present moment. So it's a wonderful anchor for practice. Taking the sensation of the breath and allowing attention to rest on the breath as we experience it. So for different people, you'll experience it in different ways, whether it's at the tip of the nose, whether it's at the abdomen, whether it's at the sensation in the chest. That's not so important. What's important is that one is attentive to the sensation of the breath. how the breath feels when one breathes in, paying attention to the sensation of the breath as the breath comes in, the beginning of the in-breath, the middle of the in-breath, the end of the in-breath. How do we experience it? Where do we experience it? To be attentive to that sensation. As the breath comes out, as we breathe out, to be attentive to the sensation and take an interest in where does one feel that? How does it feel? What is the experience like? Is it smooth? Is it kind of rough? Is it constricted? Is it kind of spacious? These are qualities to pay attention to. Not that one has to regulate the breath, but that we're taking an interest in the breath. And the breath is a an excellent object for establishing attention, because it's neutral. There's a neutral quality to it. It's not inherently. It's not that pleasant. It's not that unpleasant. It's just kind of neutral. And as we take a neutral object as the basis for our attention, we can start to recognize the different ways that moods come up in the mind. It's a good mirror for if one's feeling relaxed, or one's feeling tense, if one's experiencing something that one likes or one dislikes. It's not because of the breath. The breath is just the breath, and one can use that the breath to come back to, rather than getting swept up in the different moods or different proliferations. And it's a good anchor to be returning to, because it's like I mentioned this morning, the instruction that Ajahn Mun gave to Ajahn Chah, to recognize the difference between the mind and the mind objects, and to not be getting swept up in those objects of mind, which have no real end to them. We come back to the foundation, the basis, and when we establish that foundation, we have a wellspring of ease and clarity to draw on. One of the images that Ajahn Chah uses was when we have a good foundation in Dhamma, in our Dhamma practice, our well-being it's like having dug a well, and the water comes up into the well all the time, as opposed to having a pot or a pitcher of water that you pour out it's gone pretty quickly. But if one has a well, then there's a really an endless supply of water for you to rely on. So similarly, when we ground our practice, our meditation practice, in awareness of the breath, awareness of a we can return to that quality of awareness. We can return to that foundation of how we rely on, say, yeah, the roots of the mind rather than the objects and the moods of the mind. So this is one can easily have the thought when one is meditating, as we in breath, out breath. Man, this is boring. Is there anything going to come of this? What am I doing? It's just there's same old breath in and out, in and out. There is there's a strength that comes from being able to being willing to return to that fundamentals of awareness, and the repetition of establishing of awareness, establishing of attention, there's a strength that's developed within the heart that is able to be applied in any situation. And one starts to be able to develop a sense of confidence and clarity in the efficacy of mindfulness. When the Buddha taught his discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, he gave a certain guarantee or a certain encouragement that this cultivation of awareness, this cultivation of mindfulness, this ability to be grounded in clear attention is what takes one to a place of freedom from suffering. It leads to awakening. It seems very simple. It seems very kind of ordinary. It has major implications. There's a real transformation takes place within the heart when we're able to return to awareness and not be drawn into the reactions of the mind. Because that's what we tend to, live on. We live on the reactions and how we either run away from or run towards, run away from the things that we dislike, run towards the things that we like. So we spend our lives fundamentally running around in circles. That's actually what when liberation is talked about, one of the goals is what's called freedom from samsara. And samsara is always usually conceived of as the kind of birth and death, the realms of all the different uh, all the different realms that people can be born into. But the word samsara, all it means is, literally means wandering on. And it isn't really about a physical place. It isn't about some sort of a level of within some cosmology. It's what the mind tends to do, just tends to wander on. So that awareness is the ability to, or has the ability to cut through that movement on. It helps the mind to stop and to be clear. So that paying attention to one in-breath and one out-breath, just that much when we're really mindful, when we're really clear, when we're really attentive, notice what happens. There's a stopping that takes place. There's a fundamental change in that impulse towards going out to something else. One can be attentive and observant of this particular feeling, this experience in this present moment. When years ago, Ajahn Sumedho was approached by somebody, and they said, "I don't get this meditation. I can't do it. It just seems so difficult, and it's just this. It just seems impossible." And Ajahn Sumedho said, "Well, can you just be aware of one in-breath and then one out-breath?" And he sort of thought for a minute. He said, "Oh, sure, I could do that." He said, "Well, you got it. That's it. That's all you need to do." Of course, the trick is actually repeating that a few times. But you know, we do tend to project in terms of what we should be getting, what we should be experiencing, what we don't want to experience, what we don't want to have happen within our mind and our moods. But it's important to recognize that as that is wandering on. That is samsara. That is the movement towards birth and death. And we can always return to this very direct attention and awareness in the present moment, the breath coming in, the breath going out. Now this is where it's helpful to pay attention to things like posture, because again, there's the for one in breath and one out breath, we can bring up the mindfulness to do that. But in order to have that continuity, we need to have a relaxed physical posture. We have to have a relaxed mental posture. We can't be tiring ourselves out. We can't be pushing ourselves too much. We can't be just letting ourselves drift. So that traditionally, there's a traditional list of things to be attending to. So it's called the hindrances. What the Buddha called nivarana. And these are the Buddha described them as those qualities which obstruct awareness and hinder discernment, which is a good description of what happens to our mind most of the time. So that and the hindrances are usually, I mean, there are five sort of things: sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. Those five habits or tendencies of the mind. And those are the qualities that, yeah, that when that comes up in the mind, then the awareness is obstructed, and discernment, our own inherent wisdom, is hindered. And one of the things that's helpful is to recognize that what happens is, say, a hindrance arises, and we actually, say, we take an interest in the arising of it. Sometimes we we feel, say, beset by hindrances, or have been sometimes the subjects of multiple hindrance attacks, and of course the way we express that is that it really wasn't anything to do with us. Something just sort of came at us from somewhere and got us. But it's the these are internal qualities that they arise, they come into being, and we have either not recognized or noticed their arising, or they have arisen, and we've taken an interest in them, and we've fed them, and we've looked after them, and then once we've fed them and looked after them, it's sort of like, you know, feeding some bad tempered dog or something that comes back and bites you. One has to take responsibility to pay attention to that arising of a mood that goes towards sensual desire or towards ill will, towards sloth and torpor, towards restlessness, towards doubt. Sloth and torpor is probably the harder one to recognize. So mind starts drifting and it's unclear. But it's that actual unclarity or lack of clarity in itself that is the roots of that sloth and torpor, that drowsiness. So that we need to rather than acquiescing to it, we need to bring attention. And this is just using the breath is your fundamental tool of establishing awareness, establishing a clarity of mindfulness on the arising of the sensation of the beginning of the breath, the middle of the breath, the end of the breath, as it comes in, as the breath goes out, clarifying, taking an interest in that sensation of the breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out. As we sustain that attention, then there's a momentum of mindfulness that is built up. There's a momentum of clarity that is built up naturally. It's how the mind works. So that to take the sitting posture, the sensation of the breath as it comes in, as it goes out, one can be sometimes if you're holding too tightly to, say, like the, just trying to hold attention at the tip of the nose, it might be too hard, too difficult for the mind. The mind can't sustain its interest. So using the whole rhythm of the breath as it comes in, from the tip of the nose, past the chest, down to the abdomen, paying attention to the out-breath as it comes from the abdomen falling, sensation in the chest, the breath passing the tip of the nose. There's that whole rhythm with how we experience it within the whole body. And you can use that for energizing the mind. You can use it for settling it, sort of tempering the restlessness of mind that can come up. One can, of course, use it to clarify the objects that the mind is going out to. So the breath is a very one can use it in diverse ways, and to take an interest in learning how to do that, how to apply it in different. How do I use the breath when the mind gets dull? How do we use the breath when the mind is kind of uncertain and doubting? This is sometimes it's like with uncertainty and doubt, we tend to try to find a resolution in, say, getting the right answer. I have a doubt, I want the right answer. And, of course, the problem is with doubt is whatever kind of solution you come up with, you're going to doubt it. So that that's where just returning to the breath, returning to the body, and allowing a momentum of clarity to establish itself. And that just naturally undermines the tendency toward that uncertainty. With the feeling and experience of clarity or increased clarity, then doubt and uncertainty dissipates on its own. One doesn't need to come up with the all-wise, all-knowing answer to things. It just is a matter of being clear. And of course, seemingly simple practice of one in-breath, one out-breath at a time, it has many, many, many positive effects. It's also important that there's a certain one of the words that the Buddha uses when he describes the mind of say steadiness of samadhi. Concentration. One of the words that he uses to describe it is malleable. And sometimes we try too hard to fix the mind in its stability. But what the Buddha is trying to get us to do is rely on clarity so that there's a a malleability, there's a steadiness, there's a malleability that's able to adjust and through seeing clearly. There's a discourse where the Buddha compares the qualities of, say, like when gold has things mixed into it. He said when it's mixed with five different things, I'll probably never not come up with five, but it was like the iron, tin, lead, silver, copper, when those things are mixed with gold, then the gold is not, it's not as malleable, it's not as workable, it's not luminous, so that, and he said in the same way, the mind has these five things. When that is added to the mind, then the mind is no longer malleable. It's no longer luminous. It's no longer able to fulfill its potential. And of course, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt. These things are the hindrances, the obstructions. So that as we meditate and we continue to apply our attention to the in-breath, the out-breath, then paying particular attention to what am I adding to that, and how do I relinquish that? How do I let go of that? How do I not feed it? How do I not buy into the arising and the proliferation of those particular moods and tendencies? So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon. Work with it.